Welcome back, the Film Experience Podcast. We have another normal episode, not a SmackDown. This is your host, Nathaniel, and I'm here with my co-host, Murtada.
Hello, everyone. Happy to be back to talk about a new movie.
Yes. The movie everybody's talking about, not The Lion King, but Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And for those of you who have been hibernating, this is Quentin Tarantino's ode to 1960s Hollywood, essentially. Through the lens of the summer of 69, which is a very infamous summer when the Manson family committed their murders, and when essentially the late 60s, if any of you have read the book Pictures of a Revolution, it was not just a tumultuous time in America, the 60s, but also in Hollywood. So the late 60s are sort of the cleave between old Hollywood and new Hollywood, which is why it's an interesting time period to focus on. So the story revolves around an actor who's kind of washed up, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, and him trying to find his footing sort of in new Hollywood when his star is fading. But Murtada, you and I have not talked about this at all.
Yes.
So I have literally no idea what you thought of it.
Generally, I'm positive on it. I liked it. I thought it was a good, good time at the movies. I enjoyed, I would say, 80% of it. I loved Leonardo DiCaprio's performance. The thing with Leonardo DiCaprio is that I never think of him between movies. Like, he's not a movie star that I sort of look for what he's doing next or interested in to see what movies he's working on or anything. I don't follow him in any way. But then every time I sit down and watch his movies, I'm suddenly flooded with just how great he can be. And this is one of those instances. Like, I don't think he's ever given a bad performance. And even in movies that don't work, I know people don't like his Oscar winning performance, but I thought he was great in The Revenant. And this is probably his best performance in a while. Like, I love him even in something like The Great Gatsby. I'm surprised by how much I like his performances, and this is one of his top ones.
I am very surprised. I had no idea you were a fan.
This is the thing. I don't even know that I'm a fan. I just realize when I sit down to watch him, oh, my God, he's so great.
I am less pro-Leonardo. I do think he's given bad performances, but I was a huge Leonardo DiCaprio fan when he was first starting. I thought, he's the future of Hollywood. Like, I loved him when he was, like, a really, really young actor. Like, in Gilbert Grape and Romeo and Juliet and This Boy's Life, I even saw his very first one. So I thought, wow, this kid, you know, because he was very young at the time. He is the best new actor. And then I just got kind of bored with his performances. Like, they didn't surprise me at all. But I did think this was his best performance in ages. Like, at least since The Departed, I think. I thought it was really smart. And it almost seemed a little self-lampooning a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Which was refreshing, because he strikes me as kind of like a humorless actor in some ways, even though he's fairly good at comedy, like humorless about his own persona.
Yes.
I just liked that there was, like, that whole sequence where he's filming the TV show and he's playing the villain, and that little girl sort of inspires him to give a really good performance that day. That whole sequence was outstanding.
It was so long, but also, like, so worth every second of it.
Yeah.
Especially when they begin at the beginning, I'm like, where are they going with this? Are we just going to follow this Western TV show within this movie for, like, an hour? It's not an hour, but it's pretty long. But he's so good, and, like, it's, like, the punchline to that, it delivers so much that it's fantastic. It's the best sequence in the movie, I think.
Yeah. I have a different sequence I consider the best in the movie, but they are the two standouts, I would say.
What's your favorite sequence?
My favorite sequence is when Cliff Booth, Brad Pitt, goes to the Spawn movie ranch chauffeur Pussycat, played by Margaret Qualley. And then he realizes when he's there, wait, something's not right with this group who's living at this ranch. And so he decides he needs to see George Spahn, played by Bruce Dern, before he leaves and make sure he's okay. And I thought that whole sequence, like the amount of tension generated, was really sort of awesome. Like I found myself like clenching basically the armrests. It felt like the most dangerous sequence in the whole movie to me, even though there's only a little bit of violence and it's only at the very end, and it's not even that impactful of violence. Like, it doesn't affect the plot or, you know.
I mean, it does tell us that Brad Pitt is a killer, which comes in handy later on.
Yeah. So anyway, it, that sequence, I was like holding my breath the entire time. I thought it was so riveting.
I do agree with you that the tension in that is like, was really great. And you sort of, oh, where are we going? What is happening? I like that too. But I thought the payoff was not as great as the Leo scene, because the payoff is basically Bruce Dern waking up from sleep for 2 minutes and then going back to sleep. And I'm like, okay. Maybe preface that there are spoilers on this podcast.
Yeah, but I like the tail end of that sequence a lot when, you know, after he has the little fight, and you think it's gonna go badly for him because, you know, spoilers, the guy Tex, who's the main second hand to Charles Manson, hears he's causing trouble, so he is on his horseback and he goes running to basically fight Brad Pitt. So you think it's going to end badly, and then, like, the punchline is very, it's just like, as soon as he arrives, it's this big build up with him running on a horse, galloping on the horse, and then you just see the taillights of Brad Pitt's car, and he's just gone. It just ends. And yeah. I love that that was such an abrupt, like, no, scene's over, sorry, no big fight.
Yeah, I mean, that sequence is great. I agree with you. And that dude who plays Tex is Austin Butler, the guy who is going to be Baz Luhrmann's Elvis.
Oh, okay. I didn't recognize him right offhand. I should have been paying more attention.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie's so, there is so much in it, right? It's very meaty. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's just long scenes of Brad and Leo hanging together, and then they go on their own adventures, and then they come back again.
This reminded me a little bit of Midsommar, in that it's so long and it has like so many like really drawn out moments where your mind can wander for better and worse. Like, you can be a little bored, or you can go on a tangent in your head and you're still within the same scene. And because both movies have inspired really interesting reviews and essays by people.
And people to lose it on Twitter. Right. There's been so much discourse about this film.
But even when I don't like a movie, like I didn't like Midsommar, I do like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but even when you don't like a movie like that, I'm always so grateful, because there's so many movies that have so little substance, and I like movies that people can really like argue about in lots of different ways, not just in one way.
Yes, absolutely. It definitely gives people a lot to talk about, and you can parse it any which way. Like, there is the revisionist history, that's a lot of people are talking about that. There is the performances, there is just the sort of how it portrays Hollywood, what it's trying to say about, especially like what you opened with, which is portraying that year. What does that mean? Is there nostalgia for what was happening there? You know, there is a lot of things to sort of parse in and talk about. So which one of these topics do you want to talk about, Nathaniel?
Well, I do want to say that I was a little surprised that it's so much about television, Because when I think of Hollywood, and this is just my own biases, I'm sure, when I think of, like, the term Hollywood, which is not so much a place as, like, the movies, you know, but it actually, in the way this movie's talking about Hollywood, it's like the entire entertainment industry. And, like, it's just as much about television as it is about cinema, which surprised me. Like, I just didn't... It wasn't what I think of when I think of the 60s. You know what I'm saying? Maybe because we don't have access to television of that time frame the way we do movies of that time frame.
Yeah, and, you know, I didn't really think about it that way, but you're right. People, when you think of Hollywood, you think of movies, and especially since the most famous quote-unquote character in this movie is Sharon Tate, who was known for movies. Mm-hmm. So it is surprising that he decided to, like, the main set piece and the main character is a TV actor. But it's also, like, I think Quentin Tarantino has always been into his own things, like the things that he sort of loves and grew up with, and he always puts those references into his movies, and I guess he was doing that because his references are always sort of a little bit minor, and you have to be like a real fan of one particular thing to actually know all his references. It's not really why I liked his movies.
It's why you
like? It's not why I like his movies.
Right.
Because most of those references just fly by me and I don't notice them.
No, that's true for me too, but my take on that is that if someone has like a really rich like visual vocabulary or cultural vocabulary as he does, I love when things fly over my head because it gives me something to think about, like, oh, there's this whole pocket of entertainment that I don't know about, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know much about Grindhouse at all before that Grindhouse double feature.
Yeah.
And so it was, like, a chance to, like, learn about that a little bit. Because then I started reading more about that whole, like, indie film scene, which it was, essentially. And so I felt like I learned a lot from that movie, even though I didn't like that movie. Anyway.
I like the way that this movie was sort of shot. Not per se like the cinematography, but just sort of like the setting of everything, right? Like these tracking shots, these panorama shots. You know, Sharon Tate and Rick are neighbors, and sort of like the way he shot, he told us through the movement of the camera how they're neighbors, by like going from, you know, from Rick's house to Sharon's and back through the driveway of Cielo Drive, and the big scene with Al Pacino and Leo DiCaprio sort of set. I can't remember the name of the restaurant now, but it's a famous Hollywood restaurant.
Russo's?
I think so, yeah. And it's just sort of like, you know, he's doing tracking shots there and shooting it from all the sides. And then the frame is full of people doing other things, just like a restaurant is. So it was sort of a movie to sort of luxuriate in, even though, and I think that's why I didn't feel the 2 hours and 40 minutes, because the frames were always full of what is happening, not just what the actors were saying, but if you just, you know, if your eyes wander, there is always something to catch on to, and maybe that was one of the things I really enjoyed about the film.
Yeah, you kind of have to give yourself over to it. Like, I remember thinking, there's a sequence where, for those who haven't seen it, there's a sequence where Sharon Tate goes to just a party. And it has, like, no narrative consequence. Like, it's just, like a lot of things, it's just to give you an atmosphere of Hollywood at the time. Like, she runs into Steve McQueen and the Mamas and the Papas, and, you know, so it's like these famous people at this party just dancing, essentially, and gossiping about her a little bit since she's just married Roman Polanski.
Yeah.
And, like, that sequence I really liked, but, you know, a lot of times when you're watching it, you're like, where is this going? And then you realize it's not going anywhere. It's just giving you... It's just giving you, like, sort of, it's just placing you an immersive, like, here you are in 1968 or 1969 Hollywood.
Yeah, yes. So we talked about Leo, we didn't talk about Brad. one thing I have to say, Brad is so relaxed and amiable in this movie, in this performance.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the movie tells us a couple of times that this character is a violent man. And it's sort of, that is, I think, the build up to sort of for the ending where he becomes really violent. So they have shown it us. I remember once the ending comes and Cliff is his name, I was just like, how did this amiable guy become so violent all of a sudden? I forgot everything. And I think that's a credit to how Brad is so relaxed and just sort of seductive in the way that he looks good. He's just always speaking, you know, low, and he just sort of seduces you in that. I was taken aback by the violence in the end. I was just like, whoa, where did this come from?
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of scenes building up to it. But you're right, he's so... It's such like a chill performance that you don't really, like when he does get violence a few times in the movie, it's always like a little, oh, like a little jarring.
Mm-hmm.
Like a reminder that he's not someone to fuck with. And I really liked that in contrast to Leonardo DiCaprio, who you get the sense that he would not be good in a fight, you know? Like, he's just so used to, like, there's this joke early on about where he sort of implies that he does some of his own stunts, and you can tell he's just totally lying.
Yes, yeah.
They're all Brad Pitt, you know?
Yeah.
Or he even makes a joke about it. He makes a joke, oh, I've fallen off a horse before, but you, like, the line reading is so good that you understand that he actually fell off a horse on accident, you know? And so he's using it as like cred that he can do his own stunts, you know? It's very early in the movie. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah. Yes. I remember it. Yeah.
I loved Leo in this. I was so surprised because I just haven't loved him in a long time.
He is so amazing. Like, so great. And what did you think of how the movie portrays Sharon Tate and Margot Robbie's performance?
I feel very little about it, actually. Because, like, I mean, people are very upset about it. Like, oh, she's not a real person, so it's not a tribute to her. And my response to that is, like, is it supposed to be? Like, I think we put a lot of... expectations on this movie that the movie is not interested in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like things that we as an audience assumed about it that just are not what Tarantino is doing. And so she is more of a symbol, but I don't think it's meant to be a rounded character. She's kind of a symbol of something that was lost in sort of like this, like a pure aspirational Hollywood dreamer type of thing, because she's just in the beginning of her career. Like, things are going well. She's excited to be an actress, you know? So to me, she was more of a symbol, but I don't take offense to that because, like, symbolism and people who signify something thematically does not mean that a movie is failing, especially if they're not the main character.
Yeah, I think, I mean, to your point, I think people come to this movie because she is the most famous person portrayed in the film. People come with preconceived ideas about her and about what they are going to see of her life. And so maybe that colors the reaction to how she's portrayed, which is sort of, you know, Tarantino's idea of what she is. But also, I think I've seen as many people sort of are positive about this portrayal as many people who don't like it. And I get it. I get, like, the criticism that it's not a real character. You know, she's not shown to be doing a lot of things. But I think also I've seen people sort of love how overall positive the portrayal is. And it's a hopeful portrayal of Sharon Tate, because a lot of people, you know, it's talk about her death being like the end of the 60s and the end of hope and end of, you know, a lot of things that were happening at that time. So I think it's sort of the antidote to that. So from that perspective, I liked it, and I thought that it worked.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the scenes with her were sweet, and I never thought I would say sweet about a Tarantino picture. So I liked the mood of her scenes, but it's just not much of a performance because there's not much to the character.
Yeah.
Like, the other characters, even like the cameos, are more like actors' roles, if you will, you know?
Yeah. And it was a little bit, and I guess you couldn't have done it any other way. It was a little confusing to see Margot Robbie watching the real Sharon Tate.
Yes.
And then it's cut, and she's supposed to be the same person, and you're like, you look nothing alike. Like,
yeah, I thought that was an interesting choice. I'll just say that. Jason wrote a review at my new Plaid Pants where he talks about that and about all the movie's layers of performance. And reading his take on that, I totally liked that more. But during the movie, it did take me out a little bit. Because usually, if an actor's playing a famous actor and you see film clips, they've also reenacted those film clips.
Yes.
And this was not the case. You're actually watching Sharon Tate with Margot Robbie. So,
yeah.
I mean, that has an interesting effect, too, because it makes you remember that this is all fantasy while you're watching it. You know, it is very self-aware that it's a movie, which I don't think is a flaw, you know?
Yes, it's not.
I mean, because even the title, you know, and it's like we go into this movie with expectations, but like the title sort of shows you how silly some of those expectations were. You know, for like realism or whatever. Oh, we're doing a historical picture, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it's also to actually show Sharon Tate herself in the film. It's paying tribute to her in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not one of those people who gets very hung up on how relatives or, you know, spouses or whatever of people who have left the earth react to their performances or movies about them, because I think there's a lot of agendas that can go on with that. And real people, if you know them, we know, if we're friends with someone, we know sides of them, but maybe we don't know 100% of them. Or especially our relatives, I think that's true. So, like, I don't always put stock in that, but I have been heartened to hear that Sharon Tate's family loves the portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, because they, if you think about it, that her death and, you know, that whole thing has been exploited so often, I'm sure it's very painful for the family to be constantly reminded of it in the media.
Yes.
So the fact that they reacted so positively to that, I think, is a beautiful thing.
Yes.
Or at least that's what I've heard. It seems to be floating around that they reacted well. I'm not sure where I read it. Have you heard that, or am I making this up in my head?
It seems right, but I can't. Yeah. I can't.
As soon as I started sharing it, I was like, wait, am I making this up, or is this true? I think it's true. Which is what this movie does to you. Like, which part is true and which part are we making up?
Yeah. I mean, it's all made up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It is. Do we want to talk about the ending? Or maybe that's too much.
That's
only been out a few days.
Yeah. We can wait on that. And plus, I'm not sure I have that strong of feelings about it. Like, some people are in their feelings about the ending. Some people online.
The only thing I would say is that it was my least favorite part of the film. It was like, I was enjoying this movie, taking in, so relaxed watching it, loving Leo, enjoying Brad, but then the ending kind of sort of jolted me out, and it's like, oh, okay, now we have to deal with reality, we have to deal with violence. And I guess maybe that's the intended effect that it's supposed to have.
Mm.
But I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it. But
yeah, I don't. Yeah, the ending is not as strong as the rest of the movie. I think partially because there's not as much meat to it. It's more of just like movie, you know, like action sequence type of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I liked it though. and it's one of these movies that I liked it a lot more the next day than while I was watching it, which is usually a good sign that you should see something again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoyed it too. And, you know, this has not been a good summer for movies. So, you know, thank you, Quentin, for releasing this in August and right. and giving us something to go watch on a Friday. Like, you know, this I saw this movie in perfect circumstances. Friday night, it's been a good week. I, you know, met Philip. We had a drink before, went to the movie in 70 millimeter. It was like, wow, you can have a night out at the movies in New York again.
And something that's made for adults and not families and with little kids. Yeah, so if you haven't seen it, go see it. Unless you can't handle really violent things, because it is really violent. We should say that.
Yes. Yes. But also, like, I was surprised and taken aback by the violence, but also I'm just like, you know, I've seen almost all of Quentin Tarantino's movies. They've all been violent. Like, I should not have been surprised.
Right. I think it's because the mood of the movie, I was expecting it to be violent before I saw it, but then about halfway into the movie, I had sort of forgotten that the story that you think it's going to be is inherently violent because it's so sweet and it has this weird, like, sort of fondness for Hollywood while you're watching it, even though, you know, the storyline is more about people who aren't having a great time in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet there's all this affection for the world, so... Yeah, it took me by surprise a little bit, too, which is so silly if you think about it.
Yeah.
Should not be surprising. So I haven't seen anything else this week, but apparently you saw another movie. So very briefly, you saw Skin, which is a feature expansion of the Oscar-winning short.
Yes. I haven't seen the short, so I don't know if the story is the same or different, but basically... Jamie Bell, I think it's based on a true story. He plays this white supremacist guy who's in a gang, and then becomes an informer and sort of tries to work with this group and redeem himself and becomes an informer against his former gang. The big thing, the sort of storytelling devices that he has all these Nazi tattoos all over his body, and sort of he has to go through this painful, extreme removal of the tattoos. So every time they remove a tattoo, we flash back to a story. I hated the movie. I thought it's the worst movie I've seen this year. I'm over, you know, Nazi redemption stories. We don't need to see one more. And I'll just say this. This is a movie that stops the plot for a full scene for us to mourn the death of Jamie Bell's dog while, you know, brown Muslim immigrants are brutally and anonymously and unceremoniously murdered in other scenes. So, skip that one.
I was terrible. Like, when you told me you'd seen it, I was like, wait, why? I thought it was something you would avoid.
I've seen it. It was playing at Tribeca. I've seen it. I was curious, but yes, I regretted it. Mm.
Well, because the discourse around the short was basically what you're saying. Like, people were very offended by the short. Well, apparently not the Academy, because it won the Oscar, but... but anyway, yeah, I was surprised when you told me you went to it, because I love Jamie Bell, but I was like, I'm not sure I want to see that movie. How was Jamie Bell though?
I don't know. Like, I've seen it a while ago. He wasn't impressive. Like, I, you know, the movie is just so offensive in its storytelling and its narrative and it's sort of the story it wants to tell that I don't know. Like, even if he was great, it wasn't something that I would notice or see, because I was just so offended by everything and didn't like anything about this movie. So,
Okay. So that's a skip it for everyone in case you missed the subtlety of Murtada's anti-recommendation.
You know when I don't like something, I really don't like.
Okay, so reader questions.
Oh, yay.
Because there's only one movie. But what is it with Hollywood only releasing one movie every week lately? It's like, what? I don't get it.
I guess they're afraid of flopping. Oh, no.
And then, like, I looked through the schedule, and there's, like, these weeks with, like, 10 new releases, like, every week for the next. And I'm like, what? Like, you know, meter them out more, you know.
Yeah, they pick up again in October, I guess.
The first one is from Andy, and he says, Nathaniel, I knew you fell out of love with Renee Zellweger many years ago, but is there any part of you that is excited about the prospect of a comeback nomination for Judy? That's the movie in which she plays Judy Garland. Is there any part of me that is excited about that? There is a 0% part of me that is excited about that. This is not so much about Renee as the fact that Renee is not one of my favorite actors, and Judy Garland is sacred to me. Like, I'm not sure if I've pointed it out on the blog the way I have with Natalie Wood or Michelle Pfeiffer. Everybody knows I'm obsessed with Michelle Pfeiffer, and I think a lot of longtime readers know Natalie Wood was my favorite actor for my entire, like, childhood. Judy Garland is, like, part of the Holy Trinity for me. Those three are sort of, they are, you know, the movies to me and why I fell in love with, you know, actresses and all of that. So Judy Garland is just, she's sacred to me, and I just don't understand doing a Judy Garland biopic in which someone sings badly in place of one of the greatest, the world's greatest entertainer. So it just seems like I'm not even sure I'll see it. I'll wait till reviews.
I'm really excited for it. I really loved the first trailer. I understand having misgivings because she is singing. She's not being dubbed as Judy Garland, which would have been a way to do it. But I'm excited for Renee. She's not a favorite, but I have loved her in some things. I love her in Bridget Jones, for instance. So I'm excited for her to be back. Although I don't think she has really gone. I mean, Bridget Jones's Baby was like 3 years ago, and that was a huge hit. People all over the world went to see that. But people forget that was only 3 or 4 years ago, and it was a substantial hit. But I'm excited for her to be back, you know, leading a movie and maybe in awards. Why not? You know, more power to Renee.
Bite your tongue. No, I'm just kidding. I have not missed her. I don't mean to be unkind, because I agree that she has talent. Like, my issues with her were not ever that she was without talent. I think she's great in the Bridget Jones original movie, and I think she's great in Chicago, even though she annoys me in Chicago. I do think it's a good performance. But yeah, she's talented, but to me, it's like Judy Garland, just don't go there unless you have like a spectacular voice. Like, you're competing with the memory of one of the greatest singers that ever lived, and you're just going to let somebody who's not a trained singer do it. I'm like, okay.
I just don't want it to
tarnish Judy's legacy. That's my thing.
The thing is, I don't think anybody playing Judy is going to tarnish her legacy. It's just always going to be there. Another reason to be excited about this particular, I saw the play that it's based on, End of the Rainbow, and it was on Broadway with Tracy Bennett. And it is a very good story. Like, the play itself is set only a few days in Judy's life. There is some flashbacks. She does sing a lot of Judy's songs. You know, I'm talking about the play. I don't know what the movie kept in or took out. But the play is a contained story of a few days in Judy's life. And it is an interesting story to tell, those days where she was in London doing those concerts. So from that perspective, I think if the movie sticks to what the play was doing, and it's an interpretation of Judy, that maybe, you know, it could be okay.
Okay. That's good to hear that the play was good.
Yeah.
I did not see it, because I feel that way about Judy in general. I think the last thing I saw where somebody was playing Judy was the miniseries of Judy Davis, which was 100 years ago. Which I did like, by the way. Okay.
What's our next question?
The next question, these are, we'll do a couple once upon a time in Hollywood questions since we just discussed it. Top three Brad roles. Euro Cheese wants to know what our top three Brad Pitt roles are. I'm going to assume he means performances because it's slightly different if you mean roles.
I have top three hot Brad Pitt.
Oh, that's a good list. Share.
Fight Club.
Okay.
Legends of the Fall.
Yes.
And Ocean's 11. That's the hottest Brad Pitt has been in the movies. And you know what? I'm forgetting Thelma and Louise, but it will be there too.
So top four.
Yes, a top four.
Yeah, that's a great list because Brad Pitt is a very hot man. I'm going to go with performances. And these are, I ended up with five. I was having trouble narrowing down. So I'll just do four because seven, I think he's great in seven, but the other four he's probably a little better in. So Moneyball, which I do think he should have won the Oscar for. And I'm standing by that. Tree of Life. Thought he was amazing in. Burn After Reading, which is his funniest performance he's ever given. And Fight Club. Those are my votes for his very best performances.
Those are all great choices.
But I also think he's really good in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and that which I would also put in the hot list. For the hottest he's been on screen.
Yes, he's very hot in it.
Somehow he still has that body. Like 30 years after Thelma and Louise. I don't get it, but okay. Maybe he made a deal with the devil. Who knows?
Oh, what's our next question?
Our next question. Well, you're just bang, bang, bang. Let's get through these. This is from Robert Hammer. I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name. Sorry, Robert. If Quentin were to make another alternate history movie where things worked out better than in real life, what event or year would you be interested in seeing him cover next? When I first read this question, I was like, no way. I think we've had enough alternate history movies. But then I started thinking about, what do I always think about with alternate history? And I always think about the Oscars. And since Quentin loves movies about movies in Hollywood, I started thinking, oh, he could make a movie about any Oscar situation that I hated the outcome. I'm like, a Michelle Pfeiffer versus Jessica Tandy movie. But then...
That's like a for Nathaniel only.
Yeah, for an audience of one. But then I realized, no, his movies are always insanely violent, so either Michelle or Jessica Tandy would be brutally murdered, so I'm not okay with that. So I decided he should make very self-referential, self-indulgent movie about when Pulp Fiction lost the Oscar to Forrest Gump. So that's my answer.
Oh, that's a good one. I don't think I can come up with anything better. I was just going to say I'm not into his revisionist history anyway, so I don't want him to do anymore.
I just think that's an interesting Oscar year, and it would play right into how self-indulgent he is as a filmmaker.
Yeah. You rock that answer to that question, Nathaniel. That's the best.
Yeah, so let Pulp Fiction win the Oscar in his revisionist fantasy.
I support that.
And maybe Forrest Gump could be brutally murdered because it's such a bad movie. Okay, go
I
on.
Have one.
Okay.
This is a fun one. James from Ames wants to know, and this is totally a question to you because you love cats. In honor of the Cats trailer, what's the best real cat performance in a movie?
I mean, there are so many good choices. I have so many. But I'm going to narrow it down to four.
Oh, wow, you have four. Go for it.
I can't vouch for the first one, but as a little kid, I loved it. The Siamese cat from Bell Book and Candle. With Kim Novak, which is about, she plays a witch. I loved that movie as a kid, but I don't remember it at all as an adult. Like, I haven't seen it since I was a little kid. But I was into it at the time. And I do remember the cats, so I'm going to go with that's one of my favorites. I love Ulysses from Inside Llewyn Davis.
Great cat.
Yeah, that's a great cat. And also, while we're on the ginger world, ginger cats, for whatever reason, totally work in the movies. Cat from Breakfast at Tiffany's. Adorably named Cat. And then my all-time favorite, probably Jonesy from Alien. I think that's kind of a common choice, though.
I don't remember that cat at all. I'm like, Aliens had cat, but, you know, I have, like, a memory like a fish. I don't even remember a movie I saw last year. So.
Well, Jonesy was smart about those aliens. Jonesy survived. Jonesy knew where that when the aliens were close. Like.
So I'm just going to go, like, only a few years back and choose the cat from Elle.
Oh, that was a good cat.
Yes, and the very lazy cat from Things to Come, a double Isabelle Huppert cat.
Yeah, and as an actress, she seems like if she were a witch, to go back to witch movies, she would have a cat familiar.
Yeah.
That was a great double bill. That I remember that specifically, that those two Isabelle movies back to back, it was like, beautiful cats. And great scenes with just her and the cat.
Yes. Both cats had, like, big parts in the film.
Good answer. Okay, here's a really difficult question that I do not have an answer for, but I want to talk about it anyways. So G-Shack asks, who is the next Nicole Kidman? I mean, there's not going to be another. Let's preface with that. Because any of the, like, true greats, like, nobody becomes the next them. They are just their own thing. I think that's the mark of, like, real bona fide movie stars, is that whenever anybody says the next this person, it just doesn't happen if the person is, like, a legendary. You can be a pale imitation of them, or like a poor man's version of them, but you can't be them.
Yeah. So do you see aspects of what you love about Nicole in other younger actresses?
Well, you know, I was thinking about the question because I was like, yes, like everybody knows that we love Nicole at the Film Experience. But I was thinking about the fact that I was really late on loving Nicole. Like, she had a long career before she was one of my favorites. And she was filming Moulin Rouge when she was around 33 years old or something. So, like, even though, like, she has a couple performances early on that are very good, there was nothing like consistency of, like, greatness every time until, like, right around Moulin Rouge, I think, where she just started knocking out of the park constantly. So, in other words, there's...
I wouldn't say constantly, but she has done it more than not.
Yeah, she is a little inconsistent, but there was a string where she was really cranking out, like, genius work.
Yes, the early oats were her time, for sure, absolutely. Yeah.
So my point in saying this is you never know who's going to suddenly come into their full power as a screen actor. So the good thing about this question is you can fantasize that it could be anyone. And I do think that the early 30s are like a really, really, they can be a very fruitful creative time for actors. It could just be because that's when they're more likely to get good roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And get them regularly. And in different kinds of movies, because it's kind of like an in-between time period in life. So you can play younger, you can play older. And a lot of movies are about people in their late 20s or early 30s. So I was looking up, like, this is how hard we work on the podcast. I was actually looking up, trying to find who is the next Nicole Kidman, even though I don't believe there will be a next Nicole Kidman. So I was looking at actresses who were about to turn 30 just for kicks, you know. So this year, turning 30 this year, Lily James, Juno Temple, I'm just reading some names, Brie Larson, Elizabeth Olsen, Lily Collins. So these are all, like, people who are getting lots of parts right now. So you never know who's going to, like, ascend to, like, the next level of greatness, you know. Dakota Johnson, she's another one. So there's a lot of people in that age range that are exciting, but maybe are they going to be legends? Who knows? Mia Wasikowska, to quote Meryl Streep, she's also turning 30 this year. How do you feel about this question, Murtada?
Look at me, I'm speechless. Like, I agree with what you said. It's like, it's never like, you can't be exactly the next person because, you know, like to your point, nobody ever is. But also, Nicole Kidman is one of those actors who is not known for one thing. Like, I can understand somebody asking who's the next Julia Roberts, because you always sort of like just, there is an idea of Julia Roberts, where I think an idea of who Nicole Kidman is or what she does as an actor is more nebulous than that. So I would say maybe I would be something like, you know, what aspect do I like about Nicole Kidman that I can see in other actors? Mm-hmm. That could be a question I could answer, but even then I haven't actually thought about this, so I don't know. But like, I think what Nicole Kidman is very good at is sort of just being so, you know, like when we see her recently in Big Little Lies, she's just, there's so much feeling in every way, in everything that she does. She, you just sort of like, there's an ache in her best performances. Mm-hmm. Like when you think of that, when you think of Birth, when you think of like Dogville, there is that. Mm-hmm. So that is something I would look for in someone, and it's something, it's an aspect that I like in her, in what she gives us. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but, you know, let's put it out to the listeners. What aspect of Nicole Kidman do you like, and who do you see that aspect in a younger actor?
And more broadly, which of the actors moving into their 30s now do you think might have a very, very interesting career in their 30s? Here are some other names. I'm just going to list a few more. Turning 29 this year, Emma Stone, Zoe Kravitz, oh, no, I'm sorry, turning 31 this year. Whoops, I'm bad at math. 31 this year, Emma Stone, Zoe Kravitz, Awkwafina, Alicia Vikander. So it gives you a lot of options for up-and-coming. And let me do a couple more, sorry. I was preparing these lists. Okay, so turning 29 this year, Margot Robbie, Aiza Gonzalez, who's been in a couple things recently, Jennifer Lawrence, Emma Watson, oh, and our favorite, Murtada and I both love her, Elizabeth Debicki.
Yes.
And Kristen Stewart. So there's a bunch of people still rising, whether or not they continue to rise, because a lot of careers do peak in the late 20, or in the late 20-something years for actresses. Mm-hmm. Because of the way Hollywood is. But some of these people are going to get even better. So, yeah.
I mean, of all these names that you mentioned, I have to say, like, the person, she's not going to be the next Nicole Kidman because I don't think they have a lot in common, but just somebody who's been impressive with her choices lately is Emma Stone.
Yeah. Yes. I would agree with that. So it's a good question. Here's a very quick question, easy to answer. SFO Troy asks, when is the 1957 SmackDown? So I will say, I realize the SmackDown dates have been very hard to track this summer.
It's hard to get, like, five people to do it and get their schedules together and all of that.
So if you think it's just because I'm bad at time management, you would be partially correct. But also, it's more, it is very difficult to get panels of five people to all watch a movie by a specific date, and so, which is why the dates get moved around. And it's, you know, you have to get a certain number of people, and we like a mix of people from different, you know, like some critics, some industry people. So it's a little bit of a challenge. I do have the panel mostly phoned for 1957, but they were expecting to have done it before now, so we need to schedule that. It would probably be in a few weeks' time, because the panel's mostly together.
All right. Good news. What's our next question?
The next question... Oh, let's go back to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Very briefly, what is Sharon Tate's film legacy? Would she have been one of the greats, or was she just a marginal actress better known for her beauty marriage to Polanski and the tragedy? This is from Wesley. This is reacting to... he loved the scene where Margot Robbie goes to see Tate in the movie. It's a great scene. And I would say one of the whole reasons she still fascinates people is we just don't know. You know, because, yes, she was known primarily for her beauty and her marriage to Roman Polanski, but that could just be because she only had, you know, she died so young. She had only made 6 movies before she died. No leads yet. So, you know, we don't know. But I think the most famous of her movies is clearly Valley of the Dolls.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yeah.
She's really good in it, yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, the Fearless Vampire Killers with Roman Polanski. Here's, Charlia asked a 3-part question, so I just want to say this. When we ask for questions, please keep it to one, so, because there are so many questions, but, they're all good questions, but I just want to pick out one of them. Charlie says, I recently rewatched Mask, and besides being absolutely blown away by Cher, the movie was clearly a top contender in all categories. How was this film shut out of picture director screenplay? I found it irresistible. Was there a plot against it? You know, when I read this, I was just like, of course, yeah, how? I watched it a couple years ago when Laura Dern turned 50. Like, we were doing, like, a 50th mini-series celebration of Laura Dern. So I watched it to see her in that. And it's a great movie. And it was hugely popular in 1985, too. It was, like, one of the top 10 movies that year. And Cher was great. Everybody was great. And Sam Elliott. And yet it was not an Oscar hit, even though it was a drama that was super successful. And that's always weird when one of, like, a drama that's super successful is not, heralded by the Oscars. But then I remembered in the 80s, it was much more common because there were a lot of movies made that were non-genre, non-superhero, non-franchise. So a lot of them were successful and did not go on to Oscar love. If Mask came out today and were a drama and were one of the top 10 movies of the year, it would get Oscar nominated. Just because there's so much less competition in movies that are pitched that way. But yeah, I don't have a great answer for that, so I'm curious if other people remember the 80s. 85, that was right around when I started paying attention to the Oscars in terms of what might be nominated, but it was a lot harder to follow back then because there weren't, like, a million, there weren't any websites. And so you would read, like, monthly magazines, and occasionally they would have, like, an article on, like, a movie, whether or not it had... But even those articles weren't like, will this be nominated? It was more like Oscar buzz, you know. So I don't have an answer for that. So other people who lived through the 80s, if they recall what went on with Mask, please pipe up in the comments.
Do we have another question?
Oh, and I also want to shame Murtada while we're talking. Murtada has never seen Mask.
I thought that was our secret.
So, yeah, you should.
Yeah, that's why I was very silent through the Mask question.
Yeah.
I have nothing to add.
And speaking of Murtada, while we're talking about Murtada, the subject of the moment, Adam Lewis says, is Murtada single? Hubba hubba. Now, I just want to say, I question your listening skills, Adam, because Murtada has mentioned his husband many times on the podcast. Murtada is married.
Yes. I think I mentioned Philip in this podcast because we went to see Once Upon a Time together.
I am single, though, so if anybody wants that hubba hubba to me, that would be greatly appreciated. Okay, final question to wrap this up. BJT wonders if we think this is a particularly slim film year. We had mentioned it about the summer, but do we think overall? He's looking at the festival circuits. We've had announcements from Toronto, Venice, New York, and London. Does it feel slim this year? There are very few films I'm hotly anticipating. And my answer is yes. I don't know about Murtada, but I looked at the festival schedules, and I'm like, there's things I'm, like, marginally excited to see, and I'm sure once the festivals get closer, I'll be like, ooh, I can't wait to see this. But I'm just not, like, super eager for anything at this point.
Yeah, I feel the same way, but I'm hoping to be surprised, because you never know about festivals, right? There might be things that are already announced and it's just like a title now, and a few actors and a director that doesn't take your attention, but mm-hmm. once it's shown and people start talking about it, then it becomes a hot ticket. So I'm hoping for that, because yeah. I agree with you, the list so far have not been great, although I am excited that the New York Film Festival got the Scorsese picture, The Irishman. It means that movie's definitely coming out this year. We've been talking about it for a while. I'm excited to see it. I'm excited that New York is getting a world premiere and getting the buzz. It's a festival I love, and that's like a great get for them. So I hope it's as great as they said in their announcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I will say, like, the two that I'm most excited about, I'm not excited in the way of, like, you don't know anything about them. It's because we've been hearing about them since Cannes, but I'm very excited for the Almodóvar, Pain and Glory, and the Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Parasite. Like, those three
and Parasite,
from Cannes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those three are, like, you know, already people have already raved about them. You know, they're coming our way soon. So that those three are definitely something. You know, they're known quantities and definitely something to get excited about.
Yeah, but they're also foreign language films. So maybe it's like a thing where, like, the American pictures this year haven't been that exciting. Like, even what I would argue is the best American film this year, The Farewell, is mostly in Chinese. So American filmmakers, like, English language cinema has been a little weak this year, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, all it takes is a couple of films at these festivals to get people excited. And there, it is a year when, you know, everybody's like, you know, a lot of directors that people love are coming back, right? Like, Scorsese's is back. Quentin, we already know about his movie. James Gray, Terrence Malick. Like, there's a lot of big-name directors, but I have to say I'm more excited for what will be a surprise. Like, I don't think last year at this point we knew much of something like Can You Ever Forgive Me, for instance, or
Shoplifters.
Yeah, you know, Capernaum. Yeah. So I'm waiting for something like that. And I'm sure those will come out.
Yeah. Yeah, what's our Lady Bird this year? It's something we were totally not expecting and it ends up being like a masterpiece. Yeah.
Greta Gerwig, another director who has a movie this year that people love her work. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so thanks for all your questions. Sorry we couldn't answer all of them. We hope you enjoyed the conversation on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And we threw out a lot of questions for you during this hour. So please respond, because we love feedback. And we will try, as we enter the more robust film season in a few weeks, things start up. We will be weekly, of course, so it won't be this, like, spotty summer we've been having where there just hasn't been a lot to discuss. So the podcast will soon be weekly again, don't worry.
Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.